This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president's trip overseas this week is really one big trade mission, drumming up business abroad for American companies. So today on the broadcast, whether governments can really get that done. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's good to have you here on a Monday, everybody. Today is the 8th of November. And I know it's early yet, only Monday after all, but the economic through line this week is shaping up to be global trade policy. Yes, I know. Sorry about that. But the news is what the news is. Specifically, we're going to be talking about the ins and outs of the G20 meeting that's happening in South Korea Thursday and Friday. Leaders of the world's biggest economies are going to be talking about how we really need something called global rebalancing. If you didn't know the global economy was out of balance, well, the White House says it is, has been for a while now. In a nutshell, the Obama administration wants everybody else to export less so that we can export more and so let our economy grow that way. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports that that is not going over so well with the rest of the world.
For more than a decade, the world was America's shopping mall. U.S. consumption made up about 20% of the entire world's economy. Since the financial crisis, that's dropped nearly in half.
The U.S. for quite a while has been the world's shopper, and that made us the importer of choice.
Ed Gresser researches global trade for the Democratic Leadership Council. He says Germany and China were happy to supply us with stuff to buy.
Germany and China in particular, they're not very comfortable with the idea of shifting and getting growth more led by domestic demand. And that's sort of what the U.S. is asking them to do.
U.S. policy is pushing the value of the dollar down. Washington wants China and European countries not to fight back with their own devaluation, so products from China and Europe would be more expensive compared to U.S. goods. Harvard economist Ken Rogoff says the global economy is at a tipping point.
And there's no question that the U.S. consumer is not going to be the engine of growth in the next decade. President Obama is going to try to communicate to his counterparts in the rest of the world, if you don't help the United States export more, there really could be trouble on the political front.
Namely tariffs, which some U.S. politicians have been talking about imposing on countries like China. All of this tension stems from the fact that the global economy is shifting, says Carrie Leahy, senior economist at Decision Economics.
Countries such as the U.S. that have grown internally through the consumer must now do the reverse. We must grow more through exports. The reverse applies to countries like Germany and China.
Harvard's Ken Rogoff says the question now is,
how fast will someone else step in to replace the U.S. consumer? Can the Chinese consumer do it? Can the German consumer do it? And will their governments and their countries let that transition happen?
The U.S. trade deficit is currently more than $46 billion. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. for Marketplace.
2 minutes, which is what Stacey just gave us, is hardly enough to do justice to global rebalancing, but it's only a half an hour broadcast, so we're going to have some more on exactly how rebalancing might play itself out on the broadcast rest of the week. Part of the reason the global economy is so intertwined is because it's so easy now for people to reach out and touch each other, electronically speaking. We've got email and Twitter and Facebook and texting, and not to mention the fact that most families have half a dozen phone numbers these days. There is a new internet browser being released today that's designed to make it even easier to stay in touch. It's called RockMelt, and we've called Marketplace's Steve Henn up in Silicon Valley to walk us through it. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
I'm all right. Listen, RockMelt, what is it?
Well, it's a new web browser. The founders of this company think, you know, the way we use the web has changed a lot in the last, you know, 5 years with Facebook and Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
But the way browsers are built hasn't changed at all. So they're trying to build in all of your social networking feeds to the browser itself. So on the left-hand side of the browser, you can see all your friends. On the right-hand side, you can see all the sites you visit. And check out what's going on them, whether it's Twitter or the New York Times, just by scrolling over them.
Is it going to catch on, though? I mean, you know, I like my browser. I'm not about to switch.
Well, yeah, right? And does the world need another browser? Yeah. I'm not 100% sure, but it makes it a lot easier for you to do all the things you do online without toggling back and forth. And that was really the key insight that the CEO, Eric Vishera, had when he set out to build this thing.
The thing that really led us to this observation that the typical web user only visits 5 to 7 unique websites. Like, they only visit a handful of websites, and they visit them multiple times a day, basically going back polling for updates. And to us, the thing that didn't make sense about that is it's 2010, and the browser isn't like intelligent enough to understand that I do the same thing 10 times a day. Just have that content ready and waiting for me. And that's what we've tried to do here.
So, Steve, RockMelt is an independent company, so eventually this thing's going to have to make money. Unlike Internet Explorer, which is from Microsoft, and Chrome, which is from Google, which, as we all know, doesn't need any more money. So how are they going to make this thing pay?
Well, right now, they're not making any money at all. They want to build a big user base. But the next step will be to charge search engines like Google and Bing a referral for driving people to their site. And that's just the first step. They think they'll also be able to charge shopping sites like eBay for building those sites into this browser as well. So down the road, they think there's a really big market here, and some pretty savvy investors seem to agree. They have backing from Marc Andreessen, who was one of the founders of Netscape, mm-hmm. and the chairman of Intuit, who was an advisor for Google in the early days and is on the board of Apple.
So there is an experiential question to ask here, right? I downloaded a version of RockMelt today. Before you could even get going, you have to log into your Facebook account. I mean, it's completely intertwined.
Yeah, that's right. And when it starts up, you know, it will only appeal to people who are already sort of fully immersed in the social web. But if you live in that universe, if that's the, you know, the sort of the soup that you're swimming through every day, I think it's a lot easier to use.
Marketplace's Steve Henn on the latest in the browser wars. It's called RockMelt. Steve, thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
As long as we're on technology of a sort, let's take a turn now to retail. You know, it wasn't so long ago that Amazon.com was just a really big bookstore on the web. And then came the gadgets and the toys, the shoes and the jewelry. Today, the online retail colossus announced it's going to pay $500 million, 500 million simoleons, for the parent company of diapers.com. Yes, diapers. So what, like toothpaste next, maybe? Actually, it could be. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports that for Amazon, the distance between books and diapers really isn't all that far.
Gabrielle Blair has 6 kids. Her house in Denver is just a few minutes from the nearest store. But in that store, her little bundles of joy become major battles.
You have to fight with them at the checkout about, no, don't touch the candy bars, don't touch the gum, and no, we're not getting the Buzz Lightyear shoes, you know, that whole scene. And so if you can just take care of it online and it's done, it's so helpful.
Blair buys diapers online as often as she can, and she's not alone. The online market for household products has more than doubled in the last decade, and Amazon is hoping to expand its grasp on that market with its purchase of Quidsy, a company that's made a name for itself selling diapers and everyday products with cheap shipping.
At diapers.com, we deliver everything but the baby. Get free shipping in 2 days or less.
Amazon is hoping that Quidsy's diapers.com and its sister site soap.com will keep you buying regular household items regularly. And of course, the company tracks your clicking habits. Roger Kay is with Endpoint Technologies.
for Amazon, perhaps the most valuable part of it is the information it gets about consumers' buying behavior. It knows about these specific types of consumers, mothers of newborn infants, at a moment in their lives when they're likely to buy a lot of merchandise.
Kay says Amazon can use that data to figure out the best way to get parents to buy more stuff now and in the future when those bundles of joy are getting ready to start kindergarten. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, say so long to those two-year highs, gang. Details, numbers, music when we get there. It's tempting to daydream as you're fighting traffic to and from work every day of a time when cars will drive themselves, when all you have to do is climb in, sip your coffee, and read the headlines on your iPad or whatever's going to take its place. Google did make big news last month, sending four driverless vans down the Pacific Coast Highway. But as exciting or perhaps scary as it might be to think about life with a robotic chauffeur, that reality is way, way down the road, so to speak. Soon enough, though, cars will be equipped to help us drive better and safer, which is where we're going to start a series we'll be running this week on the future of transportation. From WNYC in New York City, Andrea Bernstein reports.
Remember how in those old movies the actors never look at the road?
Why are you looking at me that way?
And you think, how could they be so unsafe? How could they drive like that? 10 or 15 years from now, you'll look back on the way we drive today, and maybe you'll wonder the same thing. Already, some cars can see their surroundings. Mercedes-Benz and other automakers have installed radar sensors on their cars.
Sleep at the wheel.
It got my attention, telling me that I wasn't paying attention.
The car hit the brakes faster than I could. I had no idea.
But a decade from now, that will seem primitive. In the future, with a combination of GPS and wireless technology, your car will have a 360-degree view. Put the technology in more than one car and in traffic signals, and suddenly your automobile can talk to its surroundings.
Okay, go ahead.
This technology is being tested right now at the Ford Motor Company in Dearborn, Michigan. It's part of a $50 million a year research program by the U.S. Department of Transportation. On the Ford campus, I step into the test car with engineers Farid Ahmed Zaid and Joe Stinnett. Ahmed Zaid is driving.
We're in a Ford Flex, and it's a prototype vehicle that has wireless communications.
A second car, a small green SUV, also wirelessly equipped, approaches the intersection in front of us. Joe Stinnett.
We're going to drive towards them just like we weren't going to stop, and you can see the alerts.
Along with the beeps, a set of red lights flash. Ahmed Zaid hits the brakes, and a crash is avoided. Stinnett tells me a quarter of all the 30,000 car fatalities a year occur at intersections. Then we test another scenario on a regular highway. The SUV is somewhere up ahead, but a truck pulls in front of us, blocking our view. What if the SUV, six cars ahead, braked suddenly?
It takes time for those brake lights to propagate back to where you actually see them, and at that point it may be too late.
But with wireless communications, researcher Michael Shulman says there could be a day where if a car brakes suddenly on a highway, all the vehicles behind it will too.
You know, we think it's a little further out, especially because, you know, of some of the security issues that we would need to solve.
You can't have the car's wireless communication system be vulnerable to hacking, and the system can't crash. But still, the DOT is confident enough in the technology that it's almost ready to start testing 3,000 prototypes at once on a college campus or in a small town. Shelley Rowe, the head of the program, says the technology is a self-contained wireless system
that allows the vehicles to communicate with each other at extremely rapid rates of speed, which you can imagine, if you're about to avoid a crash, you need to be able to communicate very quickly.
The DOT wants the system in every new car. But if you're still driving around the wheels you bought in 1998, the DOT is hoping mobile devices can be wired to get your old car connected, too. There's another big challenge, driver acceptance. Out on the street, actual drivers are somewhat skeptical when told their car is about to get a whole lot smarter and bossier.
That's what my eyes are for.
My sister has something that beeps when you back up, and it's very annoying.
Stanford University professor Clifford Nass studies how to get humans to listen to their cars.
We actually have the car praise the driver.
Flattery, Nass says, always works.
And we find that that type of flattery encourages drivers to feel like, gee, the car cares about me, the car's thinking about me, and the car thinks I'm smart.
It'll tell you, here's the weather.
Once a car is networked, it can safely tell you more than just whether you're about to run a stop sign. Back in Dearborn, Michigan, researcher Michael Schulman is fiddling with a screen.
Can it tell you if you're passing a mall, if they have your pant size, the gap?
Not yet.
But sooner than you think, it will. In Dearborn, Michigan, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Andrea's story came to us from the public radio project Transportation Nation. Tomorrow on the series Bus Rapid Transit. Coming up, the young and the unemployed.
People who don't have work tend to be dejected people, frustrated people.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 37 points today. That's about a third of 1%. Ended things at 11,406. The NASDAQ down a point, a fraction of 1%, 2580 at the bell. The S&P 500 fell 2 points, about 0.2%. Finished at 1223. Traders turned their attention away from the Fed's Treasury buying stimulus plan of last week, focused instead on financial troubles in Europe. Financials here had a rough day. Bank of America lost almost 2%. Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, and Citigroup all dropped more than 1%. The price of gold rallied to an all-time, although not inflation-adjusted high, closed at more than $1,400 an ounce today. AOL clicked up 4.75% on increased speculation of a merger with Yahoo. AOL hired Bank of America to serve as a financial advisor to explore the possibilities. Yahoo rose 1% on the news. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose. 2.56% is the number you're looking for. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. By Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at microsoft.com/cloud. And by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Tuesday. President Obama continues his Asia tour. Next stop, Indonesia. The National Oil Spill Commission continues its two-day public hearing on BP's well blowout. And on November 9, 1906, President Teddy Roosevelt took the first foreign trip by a U.S. president to Panama. I'm Andrea Rule.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Supreme Court is going to get down into the fine print tomorrow. Contract law specifically, fine print quite literally. The justices are going to hear a case about those arbitration clauses that are in a lot of the contracts that customers sign. Clauses that say disputes have to be resolved by a third-party arbitrator. Arbitration clauses also seem to rule out class action lawsuits as a consumer remedy against corporations, and that is the interpretation that's going to be at the heart of the case to be heard tomorrow. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
All sorts of contracts, from credit cards to car leases and even stays at nursing homes, have an arbitration clause. You have to read the contract closely to find it. AT&T wireless customers Vincent and Liza Concepcion discovered theirs when they challenged a $30 sales tax on a phone the company gave them for free. When they banded together with others to bring a class action suit, AT&T tried to block it. The company said the arbitration clause precluded litigation. But citing California state law, lower courts let the case proceed. AT&T appealed to the Supreme Court. Los Angeles resident Marlon Campbell sympathizes with the Concepciones. He says his cell phone company, Nextel, tried to rip him off.
I had to call them almost on a monthly basis to let them know that there was an error in my bill.
Campbell joined a class action suit with more than 24,000 other Nextel customers, and that resulted in a judgment against Nextel. Campbell got $1,500.
It wouldn't make any sense for me to hire an attorney to go back and claim $65 or $70. It wouldn't be worth it for the attorney. It's like you're helping each other. You know, one person can't get it done on its own. It has to be done by multiple people.
Federal law, though, says arbitration clauses preclude class action suits, and the cell phone industry argues federal law should preempt the states. Banks and credit card companies agree. Alan Kaplinsky represents several financial trade associations as friends of the court. He says studies show arbitration gives consumers a fair break.
They recover amounts that are very often higher than what they can get in court. Most importantly, they're able to get a much quicker resolution.
As for class action lawsuits, Kaplinsky says consumers are often paid with discount coupons instead of cash.
They're essentially worthless to consumers. Who benefits from class actions? Class action lawyers.
But polls show 59% of Americans oppose binding arbitration because decisions favor corporations. Marlon Campbell, for example, got cash from his class action settlement. And consumer advocates say class action lawsuits are the best way to hold companies accountable for small grievances. Harvey Rosenfield is with Consumer Watchdog.
The only way you can really get a day in court is by getting a whole bunch of other consumers who've been abused just like you, finding a lawyer who will take the case on behalf of hundreds of thousands of people, and then bring that as a class action in the courts where you have rules that allow the full prosecution of a case.
A ruling in AT&T's favor would mean nothing less than the end of a consumer's right to join a class action case anywhere in the U.S., says Robert Weissman of Public Citizen.
It's going to give a free hand to corporations to engage in a variety of either deceptive or misleading practices, small charges, small fees, small ripoffs, small defects.
Weissman and other consumer advocates fear the Supreme Court will vote against consumers. He says lower courts have consistently backed state laws protecting consumer class actions, and if the Supreme Court justices agreed, they would have never accepted AT&T's appeal. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The fall of 2008, the very peak of the financial crisis, was a moment in time that nobody's really anxious to live through again. But we're still living with the after effects, the foreclosure crisis, high unemployment, general economic uncertainty. The latest book from novelist Paul Auster, Sunset Park, it's called, follows four people during the winter of 2008, just following the height of that crisis. And it begins, the book does, really the way the whole crisis started, with homes. And Miles Heller, whose job it is to get abandoned and foreclosed homes ready for resale down in Florida. When we talked, I asked Paul Auster to read the opening paragraph of the book for us.
For almost a year now, he has been taking photographs of abandoned things. There are at least two jobs every day, sometimes as many as six or seven. And each time he and his cohorts enter another house, they are confronted by the things, the innumerable cast-off things left behind by the departed families. The absent people have all fled in haste, in shame, in confusion, and it is certain that wherever they are living now, if they have found a place to live and are not camped out in the streets, that their new dwellings are smaller than the houses they have lost.
You know, the thing that struck me as I read this paragraph and then went through the book is that this guy, Miles, is documenting materialism and the materialism that we had in this country for a decade or two. And then he and his friends go on to basically reject all that materialism as they get hit by this recession and their own homelessness.
Yes, the action shifts from Florida up to Brooklyn, the neighborhood of Sunset Park, which is a large, rather downtrodden part of the city. And four of them become squatters in an abandoned house.
The people in this book, as you say, they are young, late 20s, but they do seem a little lost.
Well, They're not exactly lost. I mean, one is a drummer in a band, another is a graduate student getting her PhD. Miles is a bit lost. But I think it's about this generation of young people who really have a rough road ahead of them in the America that exists today. Shrinking job market, the difficulty of finding the kind of job they've qualified themselves for but can't find. And then the other thing that no one really talks about in America is the burden of debt that most young people have after they've finished college. And I feel that all these young people are somehow victims of this pinched state that we're all living in.
They are victims, though, you have to point out, of our generations, yours and mine, who have come before and sort of run this system and set it up that way.
Absolutely. And I don't want to get into a long discussion about what we should do in America, but I really feel that we're doing ourselves great harm by charging so much to go to school.
I wonder what you think about this statement, that this is a book in name about the financial crisis and in name about housing and foreclosure and how we survive. But it is, most of all, a book about how people relate to each other. And the question that flows from that is, how has this crisis and the economy of the past 3 years changed the way people relate to each other?
Well, people who don't have work tend to be dejected people, frustrated people. So I would think that they're behavior would be very much affected by their situations. In terms of families, one has been reading all kinds of articles about how many young people who are living at home with their parents because they don't have work that pays enough to rent apartments with. So in one way, maybe this is a good thing. Maybe it's keeping families closer, or maybe it's a bad thing in that you have a lot of frustrated young people dying to get out of the houses they lived in as children.
Is there hope, though? Do you think that coming out of this and your experiences thinking about our situation in this crisis, you know, do we have economic hope?
I think so. The fact is, I've been around a long time now, and I've seen things go up and down. This is the process of capitalism. Crashes, depressions, recessions, and then recoveries. We'll see what happens. The election has just taken place. Everything is changing once again. We'll see if anyone can come up with any interesting ideas.
The latest book by Paul Auster is called Sunset Park. Paul, thanks very much.
Thank you.
If that opening paragraph that Paul read for us got you interested, the whole first chapter of Sunset Park is on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. Coverage of the economy is supported in part by the Schuman Center for Media and Democracy. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note on the way out this afternoon. You may have seen elsewhere in the news that today is the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy being elected president, which is why this item caught our eye this morning. You, too, can own a piece of American history. A part of the cake from JFK's 45th birthday party is being auctioned off. Wouldn't make such a big deal out of it, except it's the cake from the party where Marilyn Monroe so famously sang Happy Birthday, Mr. President, to him. The cake can be yours for as little as $5,000, which is, if you ask me, kind of steep for a 48-year-old piece of cake, but maybe that's just me. Anyway, that's it. We're done. That's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow dropped 37 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ off a point, a fraction percentage-wise. The S&P 500 fell 2 points, about 0.2%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming back tomorrow afternoon on this broadcast, the era of big government is over there.
It's the individual stepping forward and the state stepping back. Small state, big individual, big society.
The British state gets downsized. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
A American Public Media.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.